This is the royal burial ground at Sutton Hoo. 1400 years ago, a great king was laid to rest under this very mound in a vast wooden ship surrounded by lavish golden treasure. Its incredible discovery opened a door to a dark age world of warrior kingdoms never before encountered. It would turn on its head our understanding and preconceptions of the Anglo-Saxons. Since its excavation on the eve of the Second World War, the treasures have been conserved and reconstructed. All that is, except for the ship itself, all 88 feet of it. But for the last 4 years, the Sutton Hoo Ships Company have been attempting the seemingly impossible task of reconstructing it, plank by plank, rivet by rivet. The original ship rotted away, leaving only a ghostly imprint in the soil. Tiny clues left behind helped the team work out the detail. How it was constructed, what it looked like, how did it move on water, and how did it reach its final resting place? But they aren't stopping there. The team want to row it on rivers, sail it on seas, and Time Team will be with them throughout this epic voyage. The site at Sutton Hoo sits on a terrace high on the eastern bank of the River Deben, overlooking the nearby town of Woodbridge. Only 8 miles from the Suffolk coast, Woodbridge has a long maritime history associated with shipbuilding and rope making. Even the great English explorer Sir Francis Drake had ships built here in the 16th century. It's now also home to the Long Shed, where a team of dedicated professionals, volunteers and enthusiasts have been busily working on this ambitious £1.5 million reconstruction.
Yeah, it's a challenge, but it's a huge opportunity. It's the opportunity of a lifetime, really. This doesn't come around every day.
A lot of hard work, a lot of forging, and quite an honour, actually.
It can be imagined, but nothing like when you see the thing for real.
The skin of the ship was that fragile, I mean, you could just stick your finger through it. So there was no wood there. It was literally just an impression in the sand. It's a ghost ship.
Planning and design of the ship took several years to research and perfect, with full-scale reconstruction finally starting back in summer 2019. But it wasn't until 2021 that the first ceremonial nail was hammered into the backbone sections.
I never feel like I'm actually building a ship until I've joined the first two pieces together.
This is a very important moment. It isn't simply just science, archaeology. Science with a sort of turbo charge of imagination. By making something, you learn how it's made. This is the largest artifact in the Sutton Hoo Mound 1 burial. It needs restoring.
And this is how they're going to do it. The build begins with the backbone of the ship. It's made up from 5 individual sections. A shallow keel, 2 extensions or underlouts attached, one at each end, and beyond those, a stem and stern post, all held together by wooden tree nails. Upwards from the base rise the wooden strakes or rows of planking, each overlapping the one below. Each of these planks is held in place by iron nails and diamond-shaped roves, coupling together to form a rivet. The shell will be built to the 5th strake, then the lower sections of the 26 frames will be inserted afterwards. The remaining strakes will be added all the way up to the shear strake and gunwale, where up to 20 pairs of tholes sit. The completion deadline for the ship hitting the water is spring 2025. Time is ticking. In the long shed, the team have constructed a softwood template known as a mould. It looks something like a ship, albeit a skeleton.
So all of the black frames that you can see on the ship, those are all lofted full size to these plans, and that will give the curve of the hull as we build her.
Apart from anything else, it now shows us the size of this monstrous vessel, so we can see what it's going to look like, which is really exciting.
Between 1983 and 1992, Professor Martin Carver excavated huge sections of the famous cemetery at Sutton Hoo. Interpreting the archaeology, particularly the 1939 Basil Brown discovery of the Mound 1 ship burial, has been a lifelong passion of his. And since its conception, he's been one of the main driving forces behind the ship's reconstruction.
Martin, it's going to be an enormous amount of work creating this boat, isn't it? Is it worth it?
Yes, definitely. And the reason it's worth it is because this is the only artifact that's been found in the celebrated Mound 1 that has never been reconstructed. So all the others have. And reconstructing it is going to give us a really imposing artifact, an imposing ship, something is going to grab people's attention. And then, of course, when the big adventure begins, which will be a few years' time, but the big adventure is to take it on the river and then take it on the sea. And so then we'll really believe that we know what it's like to be in the 7th century.
But that adventure is still a long way off. Work on the ship progresses slowly, and there's a huge amount of research, experiment and trials to be getting on with. Here we are. Right, let's meet some of the team. Incredible smell of wood. In the depths of the long shed, I catch up with the man who's got the difficult task of making the Sutton Hoo ship a reality, Master Shipwright Tim Kirk.
What information have you got in order to be able to make it properly?
This type of ship has not been built at this scale before. No one knew what it had looked like. No one's rowed a ship with 40 oars like this. The primary information comes from the 1939 drawing and the photographs of that excavation. It's basically the nail data, the nail locations from 1939. It's just a huge challenge, basically, for all of us. And at the end, we know that we'll be able to raise the curtain on the Dark Ages a little bit more. This is really the only ship of the period in Britain. So the period is around 600, 620 AD. We know it's in the Northwest European tradition, which is clinker.
Clinker is one of the oldest and most recognisable boat building techniques, where the hull planks overlap to create a watertight shell. In larger vessels, such as the Sutton Hoo ship, shorter planks are joined end to end, creating the full length of each strake. The Sutton Hoo ship is the largest pre-Viking vessel ever found in Northwest Europe. Knowing the approximate date of 620 AD, taken from the gold coins recovered in the burial chamber and the clinker tradition of the ship, means that the team can look either side of the archaeological record for other construction clues. A major source of information and inspiration have been the Needham ship from southern Denmark, dating to around 350 AD, and the later Viking Oseberg, Gokstad and Skuldelev ships. Despite the wealth of research, there are still gaps in what Tim and the team have been able to glean from the Sutton Hoo excavation data.
We haven't got any wood, which is a bit of a problem.
So you can't detect what sort of wood it was from what you've got around the rivets.
Yeah, they did detect that. When they x-rayed the rivets, they were able to detect the grain of oak, which is quite a specific grain pattern in the corrosion products of the nails. So we have got that. We do believe it was oak.
What other things don't you know and are going to have to surmise?
We don't know any of the details of the inside of the ship. Because there was no timber there and there's no fastening marks, a lot of these fastenings were wood. They were tree nails.
Yeah.
And they didn't show up very well at all in the sand imprint. And that's where this model at 1/5 scale and the full size model of the midship section behind us, that's where they're coming in very handy as research tools. Most projects like this are problem solving exercises. Yeah. You know you'll get problems and you just have to solve the problems. And when you've solved all the problems, the ship goes out and it floats.
Back at the start of the project, research focused on the outline of the famous ghost ship, discovered in 1939 by Basil Brown and surveyed by the Science Museum. Brown's recording of Mound 1 was exceptional, but he also, rather helpfully, left detailed diaries outlining the finds and how he was feeling during the excavation, which give us a vivid insight into what was actually going on during the dig. For instance, Thursday the 11th of May. About midday, Jacobs, who by the way had never seen a ship rivet before, and being for the first time engaged in excavation work, called out he had found a piece of iron, afterwards found to be a loose one at the end of a ship. I immediately stopped the work and carefully explored the area with a small trowel and uncovered 5 rivets in position on what turned out to be the extreme end prow or stern of a ship. Without Brown's intuition and painstaking work, key details of the boat's shape would never have been recorded to allow the team to create a digital model.
All the wood had gone, except leaving little bits of black dust showing where wood had been. But all the rivets were still in position. So the iron rivets which held the planks together were laid out in a line. And because it had been so skillfully excavated by Basil Brown, as soon as he got the first rivet, he recognised it as a ship rivet. He says, don't move them, just keep everything exactly where they are. Imagine the shape of a boat. We'll take the earth out and then use this pastry brush and then brush, brush, brush until it goes red. And then you've got to the rivet. So just leave it there. And so, thanks to him, we have all the rivets laid out.
That's a great piece of archaeology, isn't it? Because you can imagine even now people finding one or two rivets and carefully bringing up.
Yeah, I know. I know, you're right. It was a stroke of genius, really. And he did produce the boat, he produced the whole lines of the boat, and he produced the burial chamber in the middle.
Basil Brown's incredible discovery would open a door to the shipwrights and craftsmen of the 7th century. And all the breathtakingly beautiful gold and garnet riches which stole the limelight would be lifted quickly and taken back to the British Museum for safekeeping. Not long after this great treasure was revealed, Britain was at war, and the Sutton Hoo ship had to be hastily covered up again. There was still a lot left to discover. Angela Kerr Evans has also been a strong advocate of the reconstruction project. In 1967, she was part of a team from the British Museum, headed by Rupert Bruce Mitford, who went back to re-excavate the ship and all its rivets.
Can you remember much about first seeing the site, your first day?
Gosh, yes. There were two things that I remember so clearly. One was the sheer scale of it, because until you see this ship in front of you, it's like, wow, you have no idea how big it is. And the other thing was the colour, because of course the sand is yellow. But it was breathtaking. That's the only way I can describe it. It was absolutely blowout stuff. It was amazing.
Looking back on that dig, what did you find that was so significant?
The recovery of all the rivets and then the subsequent examination of the rivets, because before that one hadn't really thought about the evidence that the rivets could give us, because they just looked like lumps of iron. But when you clean them back, there's a huge amount of information on them. I cleaned all the in-position rivets, and then they were all actually recorded on a set of cards like this.
What did the rivets tell you about the way the ship was put together?
Well, the great thing about the rivets is that they give you the thickness of the planks at the strake overlaps, which is roughly about a thumb joint. And you can find that in the wood grain on the actual rivet. So that will give you the thickness of the plank, but only at the overlap.
It was real detective work, wasn't it?
It was very forensic, yeah. Certainly when I started the project, I never thought that that sort of information would come out. The structural details of the ship mostly come from the rivets. It's ironic that these ugly iron things should give you all the information you need.
So the position of the rivets was pretty key.
When the Science Museum recorded the ship, they recorded the lines of the rivets. They surveyed them all in. And so that gave one the lines on which the subsequent plans were drawn up.
Are you excited about the reconstruction of the ship?
Oh, yes, I'm wildly excited. I mean, for me, it's the culmination of an ambition that I've had ever since I worked on the rivets back in the day. But on the other hand, for me, it also adds a layer of responsibility, because a lot of that information that's going into that ship is based on what I wrote on the rivets. And so I'm keeping my fingers crossed as well.
What's clear from all the diaries, photos and plans created from the archaeology is that the rivets are literally the linchpin to the characterisation of the ship. Back in the longshed, Tim and first shipwright Laurie are experimenting with prototype rivets on the full-scale midsection model. This is designed as a research tool for the team to try out techniques before using them on the real thing.
So these are our final prototype nails. And these combined form the nails that keep the ship planks held together. So we're going to drive the nail through the planking, put the rove on, cut the excess off, and then peen the nail, spread the nail over the rove. And that's what secures the ship together, hopefully. That's it, that's gone in. Now these roves are slightly too large for the nails, so we're going to have some slight adjustment made in the production batches. Just another 3,598 to go.
Once the prototype rivet is approved by Tim, it's down to Alex Pole in Dorset to produce the full 4,500 of them required for the job. We've come to see how both the rivets and the roves they attach to are made.
We've been given the specifications by the ship's company, the Sutton Hoo Company, and from the British Museum. Traditionally, smiths would have taken large lumps of wrought iron and then hammered them down into longer, thinner pieces and then made their rivets from that. We live in the 21st century. We've been supplied with stock that is already rolled. So, yes, we're sort of halfway there. But also there's several other processes we need to go through to get to a proper rivet. Mostly this is scrap wrought iron that's reforged and re-rolled. They take it from old ships' anchor chains. It might be old railings.
Ah, so some of the rivets used in the Sutton Hoo ship could have started life as a ship elsewhere and been recycled.
Yeah, I think it could. Yeah, it could have been, yes.
With instructions from Alex, Derek gets a chance to make his own rivet for the ship.
So you can see we've got two gas burners. It's mixing with oxygen and then it's increasing the temperature. So it's a nice, clean, consistent fire.
How's that one looking? Is that a success?
That one looks good. Yeah, it's nice and clean. One of the issues we have with using wrought iron is that it tends to split. So that's why we need to get that really, really hot
temperature up at the end.
So these little mushroomy cracks.
Yeah, they're tiny little cracks. We are going to reforge this, so some of the cracks will come out and we'll tidy it up a little bit. But that happens irregardless of whether you're using a hammer or a press. It's just the nature of the material. If we put that in there, over the pritzel hole. Bring it out and just tap it on the... Perfect.
Possible.
There you go, ribbon. Yeah, that's great. Perfect.
It's so soft, isn't it?
Yeah, incredibly soft material. Is the head, you've got the shaft of the rivet, it's nice and straight, and then you've got very, very slight taper on the end. That just helps drive it through the timber, and also it's a little bit easier to put the rove over the end.
Here we go, Derek. I've just polished the head of the rivet. Got really nice colour, got your initial on it. That's one finished rivet for the ship. This is a finished rove. We've had them laser cut. So traditionally you would have a long bar and you would slice it up. This is how we made all the original samples. Mm. They were all forged from scratch. And then you would punch a hole through the middle and it would produce this really interesting shape.
Yeah. Using a laser cutter is very much the modern meeting the traditional.
This is a much more cost-effective way to produce, in principle, the same result, but en masse, but using traditional techniques.
How come they're diamond shaped? Surely a square or circular feels much more functional.
I think a square would be easier to make. Mm. It would use less material. And from the archaeology, the roves were all lined up. So this not only is very functional, very practical, this is an essential part of the process. Yeah. It's also decorative.
Oh, wow, so essentially they're making a style choice there.
It's a style choice and it's a feature of the Sutton Hoo ship. And I think this is part of their indication that this was a very, you know, prestigious build. It was built for someone of importance, certainly, because this would take a lot more time to produce, more time to fit, and also has that beautiful decorative aspect.
And this decorative richness and dating of the burial has always begged the question, who was in the ship?
From the fact that you are an Anglo-Saxon specialist, who was our chap?
Well, Radwald is the most famous East Anglian king, but he's not the only East Anglian king. There's powerful kings before him, and there's very interesting kings after him. The problem with putting Radwald into Mound One, I mean, it's a tempting thing to do because he's the most famous king. Here we have this marvellous intact ship burial. Put the two together, Bob's your uncle. But actually, of course, you have to remember Mound 2, which has also got a great big ship in it, but it was robbed several times, probably. If it hadn't been robbed, if that had survived to be looked at, we'd have had two competing grand ship burials. So you need two famous dead kings. This has always been my problem with giving Mound 1 to Radwald. Why should he not be in Mound 2? And then who's in Mound 1? There is a moment in the 630s where two kings die at the same time, and that I would suggest might be an alternative theory. Sometimes people act as if Sutton Hoo is fully understood, and that makes me very surprised because we might know a lot about it, but it is certainly not done and dusted. It has a lot more to tell us and it's still full of mysteries.
Whether this warrior king was Radwald or not, his final resting place of a ship littered with treasures must have been intended to express a greatness that has now become legendary. It's essential that the team refer back to the archaeology to make it as authentic as possible. And one of the ways they can do this is through the tools they use.
Big moral question. Yeah. Are you going to use the kind of tools which you imagine that they would have used when they were first making these boats, or are you going to use Black & Decker?
Important part of the experiment to see what it's like using the kind of tools that Anglo-Saxons would use in the 7th century. And we did have some excavated tools. The tools are much the same as they are now with carpenters and joiners In other words, you have an axe, you have a trimmer, you have hammers, you have spoon bits, things like that. So those things were all legit for remaking the kind of tools that we made to build the ship.
There are certainly a variety of tools being used in the longshed, some more familiar than others.
Well, this is a standard hewing axe, double bevel, straight handle. That's a side axe, right-handed side. They're used for a right-hander, single bevel.
Now, I don't know if this is modern or not, but it certainly looks it, as that one and that one. But this, Richard, you don't find these nowadays, do you?
No, not commonly, but they're actually based on a design seen in the Bayeux tapestry.
Really? What is it?
Well, it's a finishing axe, which is used to get a slightly finer finish on all the surfaces that we are hacking away at to produce a plank or whatever.
Can you show me how again?
And this is used to produce a finer finish.
And the rule is that the hand tools that you use are like the ones that they used in Saxon times.
Yeah, and you've seen the main tools here. There's one other that gets used.
Yeah.
Actually, there's one here which is called, it's called a draw knife. And it's called a draw knife for the reason that you draw it, you pull it towards you. So if you wanted to just smooth this finish off here,
really effective,
it acts like
it?
A plane.
Yeah.
And these are used at the moment for making oars.
And you've got to do it, haven't you? You're making something to be as authentic as you can, so you've got to use the authentic tools.
Yeah, and it's very satisfying being able to use Anglo-Saxon tools for a project such as this.
The ship's company rely on the wide skill base of more than 100 project volunteers and over 30 craftsmen and women to help with the build. They come from all over the world, and have been instrumental in getting the longshed buzzing with activity.
So we've got aeronautical engineers, we've got nuclear power station engineers, we've got all sorts of various different skills that people have brought to the project. And then we've actually taught them the techniques to build the ship. Very few shipbuilders.
I was in for about 8 years in the Navy, but I was on a ballistic submarine, so we would dive in one place and 3 months later come back up in that same place.
The scale of it is quite amazing. This is probably one of the biggest wooden boats I've worked on.
So my official title is Truewright, and that stems from the Anglo-Saxon word for woodworker or trewyrter. My background is more in using axes, green wood and timber framing rather than a boat builder.
No, the biggest thing I make is furniture, and this is basically a big piece of furniture to me.
As wood is the main ingredient of the ship, getting hold of it is one of the major occupations and focal points in the longshed. But it isn't just any wood. The team need large, freshly felled oak trees for the huge lengths of the ship, and lots of them.
In my previous career, if I wanted some wood, we'd go to the local timber yard where they'd have everything that we wanted. Here, because we wanted trees as green as possible, we had to go to the field. And that was another of our volunteers, Richard Symes, who said, "I'll give you a tree from my farm."
I was staggered at the specification of the timber. They want very, very particular trees. They want the very best straight, knot-free, large oak trees, which are rare now. And to my surprise and delight, other farmers and landowners have said, "Yes, we'll donate a tree." That log that they're working on behind you came from 4 miles away, just down the road.
Do you think the original shipwrights saw a bunch of trees and thought, right, that's how long my ship is going to be? Or do you think they'd worked out the length before that and then went looking for the trees which would be appropriate, which is what you did?
Well, as far as we know, actually drawn plans didn't come in till about the 14th or 15th century. And so this would have all been done from the shipwright's experience and their eye. And in fact, we've experienced that as well. There was a tree almost in the shape of a question mark. And I just had to take a guess and base it on my experience that that could be the shape that we needed for the extension to the keel. And when we got it back and we put a plywood pattern on it, lo and behold, it almost fitted perfectly.
And it's Tim's expert eye that has been identifying the best timber for the project. It took over 18 months to find the perfect straight tree for the keel.
That's a lot quicker than some I've seen come down. It is pretty straight, isn't it?
Yeah. Our first job was to find a keel, and that was brilliantly done by the shipwright. We knew what it would be like. We knew that at 27 metres long, there wasn't going to be a single tree, especially not curving in the way it needs to curve. And so it was worked out that there were five bits to this keel.
The keel forms the flat base at the centre of the backbone. Attached at either end of the keel are the underlouts, which extend it and begin to curve upwards. The stem and the stern post are then attached to the underlouts and rise upwards to form the ends of the ship. Tree nails then secure each of the sections together. It's a complex process to make the ship watertight. The holes where the tree nails secure the wood in place could leak if not drilled correctly to fit them. Research based on the Needham ship showed that the tree nails needed the head on the inside of the keel to avoid wear and tear.
The more this wears away, the more likely this tree nail is to come out of its location. Whereas if you put it the other way around, you've got a wedge in here for about 2 inches.
Evidence from the original archaeology revealed that the ship had a shallow keel, meaning that it could be pulled easily onto land without damage. Perfect for travelling to its final resting place. A couple of months on from the first nailing, and it's nearing Christmas. The volunteers are busy working on the backbone of the ship. Despite the cold, there's also festive activity happening on the River Deben. Built back in 1993, the Say Wilfing is a half-length reconstruction, an eighth of the size of the Sutton Hoo ship. For the past few months, she's been the focus of the ship's company's water trials, introducing volunteers to a rather unique style of rowing. Jack Barnard is the company's project manager and oversees all the organisation, fundraising and rowing-based research in the Longshed.
I oversee over 140 volunteers, all doing an amazing job. For me, this whole sense of community and people pulling together and really wanting to be part of it is what is absolutely unique.
One of her main priorities is understanding how the Sutton Hoo ship would have moved on water. She started to put a Saxon rowing squad of around 120 rowers together, and Time Team's Helen Geek is first in line.
Is it possible for somebody of my physique, fitness and age to become one of these rowers? Because it just sounds so exciting.
You know, I started rowing in my early 40s, so I haven't done it my whole life. We need people that understand the discipline of rowing. We need people to be able to follow the right instructions and do the right things at the right time.
The weight of the oars is just incredible.
We're not 100% sure that we've quite got this design right yet. There's an argument that they should be half a metre longer than this. Through the testing phase, we will have to keep putting oars and people in boats to find out what the inboard and the outboard measurements are. Yes. So that's the, you know, the pivot. So say this is the oar, the point at which the oar will go in into the thole and be pivoted through the water.
We've got an extremely exciting month ahead. This June, Time Team is excavating at Sutton Hoo, the first excavations there in over 30 years. We're working in partnership with the National Trust for a special dig investigating Gardenfield, a little known area of the site. We'll also be test pitting in the landscape, shedding light on the wider context of Sutton Hoo. Throughout the month, Time Team will present a range of exclusive coverage, opening and closing with two live shows right here on YouTube. What's more, members on Patreon will be treated to additional dig watch coverage, daily 360 cam live streams direct from the site, Q&As with the team, 3D models and much more. You really don't want to miss this, so make sure that you subscribe to this channel and consider joining us over on Patreon to catch all the action as it unfolds.
After plenty of Christmas revelry, the new year gets off to a messy start. Alec is preparing the caulking on the stem underlout section.
The thing is, when you use things like axes and chisels, there's always small tool marks and things, which is why we use caulking. And this essentially seals the joint. And you can use lots of different things for caulking, from animal hair, fabric, wood shavings, sort of plant fibre material, all sorts of things. What we'll be using is based on what was found in the Needham ship, so which is a mixture of wool fabric and pine tar and fat.
The time's come to put the final backbone sections together.
So we'll be using two engine hoists. It's a little bit of a delicate operation because there's quite a lot of weight there, and we've got to obviously be careful we don't squash anyone. Or when we get it in position, we'll then have to build supports so then we can take away the big sort of gallows-shaped structure behind. We just call it the gallows because it looks a bit like a big set of gallows.
There we are. With the stem in place, the ship now extends its full 88-foot length. And from above, the outline becomes much clearer. Martin has come to the long shed to see the latest developments. At the stern end of the ship, he and Helen explore how the strakes will be added to the backbone.
So what are we looking at here? This is the underlout.
This is the top of the underlout, and it's been hollowed out. And so that effect means that the edges of the top of the underlout, they're coming up to us at the angle that eventually the planks will come up.
Oh, so this is almost like the bottom of the first... The top of the first plank.
Yeah,
it makes a tiny little stub.
So it's joining this solid piece of oak.
So you can get your rivet in through there, out through there, with your rope, and hammer it flat.
A hollow in the underlout allows the nail rivet angle to remain parallel to the plank land, neatly fastening the rove on the inside. This means that it can lay flat against the timber, creating maximum strength as a fastened rivet. But Tim has some disastrous news. There's a problem further along the underlout's length, and it's looking like a major setback.
So what's happened here?
Well, in any tree, you've got the very central part of it, the pith. We found when we hollowed this out, after we'd set it all up, that we've actually run into the pith of the tree,
which
isn't good. You can actually see daylight through there. So there is a full split through there. This has probably been cut a year now, this tree, and it's still drying out. So this is going to grow. So we've got to take a choice of either to repair it, either in a traditional way, or a more modern way, or to replace it. So it's a piece of timber 15 feet long, and I think it's about 2'6", 750 mil diameter, something like that, the log.
The discovery that we need to hollow out the top of the underlout has revealed that. So you wouldn't have known that was going to happen.
Is there any chance you could just sneak in a new underlout?
The problem with clinker boat building is because the planks overlap, we'd have to get this piece out. If it was all planks, we'd have to get this piece out. We'd probably have to take this plank out and the next plank.
Yeah.
And it becomes a major job then. So it's much more effective to take a decision now before the planks are on.
When do you have to make the decision? How long have you got?
By Friday afternoon, probably. Not quite as quick as that, but it's imminent.
This is terrible news. It's taken over 400 hours to create the underlout section. And if it has to be replaced, the whole project will be set back by months. It takes an agonising 2 weeks for the team to come up with a decision.
Have you decided what to do?
I think it's worth saying that it wasn't easy. You know, we had quite a difficult fortnight trying to make our minds up, and many of us swung this way and then swung the other way.
Yeah.
Shall we repair? Shall we replace?
The first thing to do, really, was to take a slot out where the defect was and actually look how deep it went and what angle it took. And basically, the defect has more or less gone from the bottom of the trough. Up here, it's a bit different because it goes right through to the other side of the plank land there. And this part actually is detached. The modern boat builder in me says, trust the materials, the epoxy resins will mend it, and we'll save ourselves the 400 hours and the grief of looking for another tree that will make that work. And as a Saxon shipwright, I have to think of it in a totally different way. As an archaeologist, I would say, yeah, that reasoning is right. And yeah, it swayed me. So. Well, in the end, we had a vote, didn't we?
We did.
The only real way to solve the issue is to replace the piece of timber.
Yes.
I will try and find a tree of a larger diameter.
After all the hours of work that have gone into the underlout, Laurie takes it quite hard.
Gutting, really, that we're going to have to replace it, but it'd be a much better decision to do it now than later on.
Now the ship is taking up the full length of the long shed, storage space is limited and wood management's causing problems.
Yeah, this section of the log here, it was in obviously one long length, but we had to cut it into three sections to be able to move it and also get it into the long shed.
And as the ship progresses, more wood is needed. Tim takes the midship model templates into the forest. He needs to find the right trees suitable for the frames, planking, and to replace the faulty underlout. He's spending a great deal of time in a lot of forests staring at trees.
That's a nice tree, that is, you know.
It's autumn 2022, 1 year on since the first tree nail went in. At the National Trust Blickling Estate, two of their ancient oaks matched Tim's specifications for planking and have been felled by Forester Gary. Tim's come to measure up.
I think that's one of the biggest ones in here.
Straight.
That is a lovely bit of wood.
We're looking at pieces 4, 5, and 6 metres long. So rather take an 8 metre length and waste 2 metres.
Do it in two.
Do it in two fours.
Two fours.
And then we've got the widest bits for the middle part of the ship. And
yeah.
It eases it then for you to,
yeah, okay,
to get it out. The grain wanders off just a little bit in places, but I think we can get around that. Apart from that, it's a beautiful tree. So yes, please, 2 4-metre length.
2 4-metres.
Thank you.
Right, we better get marking.
Can't get over really what a beautiful tree this is and how fortunate we are to have it. This end, the bark, the fissures in the bark really are dead straight up and down the tree. There should be no twist in it whatsoever. As we get up to here in this section, it does begin to dive off just a little bit down there. So in this quarter of the tree, we're going to have to be careful that it cleaves true. But it should be all right.
Sadly, one of the trees shows just how easy it is not to see the imperfections before it's felled.
This is a really clear example of how you can't tell what a tree's like till you actually see the inside of it. This looks beautiful all the way up it, dead straight. But as soon as you fell it, you can see all of this area here is rotten. So it's had rot tracking up the roots, and it's really soft. And you've got these white spores on it as well. And it's absolute rubbish. So if it goes 2.5 metres up, I've still got a 4.5 metre log potentially, which is a good long length of timber for planking. So all is not lost at the moment.
Tim starts earmarking some of the larger tree branches for the more curved parts of the ship's frame, but without much success.
There's nowhere near enough curve in this limb to make that curved piece of timber from. So we'll have to go and look for another tree. And this is going to be, I think, probably more difficult than finding the planking for the ship. Actually finding the timber for the frames is going to be the most difficult thing. And I reckon I'd be spending most of the next year in woodland like this, looking for new trees that are being cut down, not for the beautiful straight trunks, but for curved bends.
Over the summer of 2022, a timber was located in the Woodland Trust's Haynort Forest, and work progressed in replacing the old split underlout. Finally, it's ready for the team to test whether all the effort has been worth it.
We'll need to actually physically lift the moulds up because, again, the new underlout is deeper because we've got to allow for shrinkage. If you try and put it in on an angle, it won't go in because it'll be too long then. It's got to go in square to the centre line of the ship. But once we've got the holes drilled, then we can fit those two tree nails to secure that end. So it's been quite a job to make that. The volunteers have done a fantastic job. There's about 430 hours to turn the curved round log into this piece. It's a lot of work. And woman hours.
We just need to go towards the front of the boat, to the bow of the boat with it. Now try it.
As the underlout slides in, everyone's on tenterhooks.
All the screws are all still tight up that end. So I think we need to take all the screws
out. Oh, that's all right. Yeah, that'll come up. So does that look straight now?
Yeah, it looks really good, Tim.
After a final push, the replacement underlout settles into place. But it does reveal how much shrinkage has already happened.
As it's thinner, it's actually dried quicker and pulled down at the sides.
Yeah, when you put the straight edge on there, you can
there's a lot of dip see. There, isn't there? So there's what, a quarter inch there? Yeah.
Probably.
So we can either leave it and see how it dries, or we could put a batten along there, clamp the two together and force this to go down to match that. But it's amazing how much it's shrunk. It's because it's so much deeper in the middle, isn't
it? That's right. This side's almost perfect.
The business of the shrinkage really intrigues me. Do you build everything 10% bigger because you know that it's all going to shrink at about that rate? Or do you have to put different shrinkage factors into different parts because you know there'll be different stresses on it?
We know that the plans are slightly oversized in terms of the cross sections. And so as it shrinks, that should bring it down to the right size.
Am I right in thinking that Oxford University came in order to measure the shrinkage for you?
Yeah, we've taken about 8,000 individual images of the ship, and you see the index marks on the boat, and they can put all that data into the computer. In the end, it produces a digital composite of the whole ship, which we can measure almost to millimetre accuracy. So we can actually tell how we started building it, how accurate we were, how much it shrunk. And then if we do it again once it's in the water, we can see how much it swells up. And I'm not sure that's ever been done in a reconstruction yet.
With the position of the underlout finalised, the freshly made tree nails are put in their newly drilled holes.
All right.
Yeah, keep going. Yeah.
I can't see it.
No, of course not. No. That's it. Slow down. More rhythm, slow down. That's gone really well. We had a little bit of a problem there because we didn't wedge the stern post far enough out of the way once we'd got the corking on.
We took it out again, rearranged it all, knocked the stern post back up a bit further to give ourselves more room, and then second time it worked out really well, so we're chuffed with that.
We've got to let it season a bit. We can't really nail up to it in its green condition, so I don't think we'll be nailing onto that until after Christmas, possibly as late as Easter.
Now the replacement underlout is secure, focus can turn to the large amount of planking that needs to be created. And in the long shed, nothing goes to waste.
So the chippings will go onto local paths to recover those, and any big bits like this will then whittle down and make wedges.
Over in another part of the long shed, Jack has been trying out the prototype oars, which were modelled on the Needham ship. She's seeing how they work in the midship model's oar holders, or tholes, which are based on a photograph of an imprint at Sutton Hoo.
What I'm finding is where this oar, given the weight of it, is sitting on this shear strake here, it's not sitting at the back of this wave, the bit where you would actually pivot it. So I'm actually pivoting on the shear strake and not where I would expect to, which would be here.
The thole is correct and the oar is too small in diameter where it crosses the gunwale.
So if we can build a prototype that's much wider here, we think that will sit in the back of this wave and hopefully give a lot more stability to the oars. We still have quite a lot of research to do what I would like next spring, and we've got two or three prototype oars to actually get this put into the River Deven and see what it feels like.
Detailed study of the 1939 excavation photographs have enabled the ship's company to recreate features like the tholes for the oars. But it's only relatively recently that the two women who took them have been given the credit they deserved.
The remarkable thing was the extraordinary coincidence of these two schoolmistresses in Suffolk, Miss Lack and Miss Wagstaff, who were looking for material to do their photographic diploma, if you like. And Miss Lack took several hundred photographs with her Leica camera of every detail of the ship. She put scales in, and all the details of the ship, the photographic details of the ship in 1939, are down to Lack and Wagstaff. I mean, it's quite amazing. And that's where a lot of the information on the reconstruction comes from.
The re-excavation of Mound 1 in the 1960s was designed to re-evaluate and answer as many questions about the ship as possible.
Why? You'd had this massive dig in the late 30s.
The 30s, I know, yes.
And it seems almost as though you were doing the whole dig again.
Well, it was a bit like that, but there were always questions about the ship that hadn't been answered, which Rupert Bruce Mitford thought could only be answered by excavation. Did it have a rounded stern was one question. Then there was, did it have a sail? And various other questions about its construction.
So the purpose of the dig wasn't necessarily to preserve it. It was to answer questions that hadn't been answered first time round, or maybe had been answered
absolutely.
Wrongly.
Absolutely. It was a question-based archaeological excavation. And some questions were answered, and, of course, some questions still remain unanswered. Always will.
Although it seems pretty clear that the ship would have been rowed, there's still some debate that it may also have had a sail.
The question about whether it moved under oars or sail is a very, very important question, and one that's given us, exercised us a lot. So the Sutton Hoo ship itself didn't produce any oars, so nobody found any oars. But there were patterns in the side of the trench. So there's no doubt that it was rowed, but there was no mast, so there was no evidence that it sailed.
But you are going to sail her, aren't you, even though there was no evidence of a mast?
Well, we are. It's always a balance between authenticity and experiment, because authenticity means that you're starting from something you know. An experiment means you're going to something you don't know, otherwise you wouldn't do the experiment. Is it likely that this boat sailed? Yes, it is likely. Why is it likely? It's likely because all around the island of Britain, in the Iron Age and Roman period, there are sailing boats. In fact, the sailing boats everywhere except in the North Sea, which is where everybody's been looking. So they say, well, there are no sailing boats in the North Sea until the Vikings, so why do you think you've got to sail?
And Martin had already had experience sailing reconstructions when, in 1989, he joined the crew on the replica Viking Oseberg ship in Norway. Although that didn't quite go to plan.
We had a research question, as you always do. Our question was, this boat sailed. They definitely had a mast. So if it did sail, could it tack? If it could tack, then a small crew could take a large amount of cargo in the right direction. If it couldn't, then you need lots of oarsmen. So it was quite an important question, I think. We did our rowing and then we put the sail up. And when we put the sail up, this ship took off like a leaf being blown across a pond. I mean, whew, like that. We had to keep pulling to get it up, and then we got the sail up and we were racing along. So it's like baff, baff, baff. It's like aquaplaning. So a very thrilling ride. And then we decided to see whether we could tack and had one or two goes at it. And every time we did, because it's got a keel but not a big one, ship tipped over like that and water came in through the oar ports. And it mostly flowed out again, but of course underneath they had all this ballast, and so water was actually making us lower and lower in the water, which we couldn't see. So eventually the inevitable happened, another attempt to tack. The whole boat sort of went and just leant over and capsized, and it was like a lorry going into a sand trap, you know, it sort of stopped. And then I was on the side by that time, and some people were already in the water, and I thought, I'll stay on the side. You know, it's wood, it's bound to float. It took about 30 seconds, and it was blub, 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 up to the bottom. Lots of ropes curling around. So it was, yes, it was quite an adventure.
It's early morning at the beginning of December, and some of the recently felled trees are on their way to Sutton Hoo from the Blickling estate.
I managed to just about squeeze this one on the trailer and it didn't like it, but I got it on the trailer.
Sorry, it's not that one for here, it's this one for here.
This one.
This one and the one on the far side.
Right. Yeah.
Once they're seasoned, they'll eventually be made into planks by the volunteers.
If I'm right, they're about 250 years old and so they're beginning to go over their best now.
Nice.
They should keep us busy for a while.
Yeah.
This will be some of the biggest trees we've tried to cleave.
We've not cleaved any like this yet.
No. Yeah.
The hydraulics make it easy. They can sit there now till probably Easter. Now we've just got to load the other ones on and go to the long shed tomorrow.
Next day, things are getting mildly festive as the remainder of the oaks arrive at the long shed.
So this is the lower half of the big log from Blickling Hall. To get this down to the first stages of the planking, first we'll have to split it in half. That's the most difficult because obviously we've got two big halves of a log there and each weigh about 3 tonnes. Then we split it into quarters and begins to go a bit more quickly then because the pieces are more manageable in size. The aim is that we put 2 pieces of planking on the ship each week next year. So there's, in theory, 8 weeks of planking work here.
The midships model has been an invaluable training tool, helping the team learn how to construct some of the main components of the ship. They also have a much smaller model built to 2 different sets of lines that has enabled the team to figure out the complexities of the twist, bevel and widths of the planking.
This is our 1/5 scale model. And originally we were going to use this to take the dimensions
to translate to the full size. So we would build this at 1/5, multiply everything by 5, take the correct bevel angles, and that would enable us then to transfer it to the ship. The 1939 excavation and the photographs and the 1975 publication suggested that these two narrow planks were here for a specific reason, which could have been to do with getting the required twist in the ends of the ship. So the line goes from nearly horizontal here to close to vertical here. It's about a 70-degree twist. So to induce twist and bend into the plank is actually very difficult to do.
It seems that the wider the plank, the harder it is to twist. This has put the digital drawing, which the team were working to, under scrutiny.
So we've decided now that we will build the full-size ship to this set of lines. This model gives us the opportunity to experiment with that.
It's the 21st of December, but before they pause for Christmas, Tim's keen to pick up the pace on the planking. They've already lost months of work making a replacement underlout. Laurie and Tim are preparing the garboard strakes, which are the first rows of planking that sit opposite each other either side of the keel. To make up time, planking had to start higher up the stem rather than as a series of strakes from the base because of the gap left by the split underlout.
This is the first piece of the garboard strake, and it's been clamped in place for about the last 5 or 6 months now. So it's actually set in the twist that we want. And we're just now going to just adjust slightly the bevel we've got on the bottom edge of it so that it clears all the rebates in the keel.
This has got to be one of the oldest tools we've got working on the boat, I think. This draw knife. It's got 1918 stamped on it.
My brother-in-law is a bee farmer in Wales, and we asked him for some beeswax, and he gave us 15 kilos, which was possibly rather more than we wanted. But we've given that to the ship project, and it's going to be used in caulking experiments, which is really exciting.
While the garboard strake's being put in place, Laurie makes up a festive Christmas concoction using some of Helen's family beeswax.
There's about 250 grams of animal fat, 100 grams of Stockholm tar, and about 12, 13 grams of beeswax.
I have brought my father Christmas hat.
Is that just for something for Christmas?
No.
It's to pour over the turkey and get an interesting glaze to the turkey.
You would. You'd get, you'd put hairs on the chest, wouldn't you?
Make sure he's on it.
Yeah.
Jack, stop. That's no good. Rove's split on this side. Whoa, that's pulled that.
What happened there?
Pulled the head off that nail.
No. What, just from me cutting it? This hole must be jinxed.
Probably everything that could go wrong did go wrong. We managed to pull the head off one of the nails, which was a very big surprise, and we'll need to go and see what's caused that. It's going to be very interesting making sure we get a consistent technique and a consistent level of tension in the nails. And I think we're going to find that as the ship dries, as we build her, we will have to go back again and just check that these nails are all still in tension once she goes in the water.
It's always a bit nerve-wracking. It's just nice to get a plank on, fixed on the boat, and feel like we're getting somewhere now.
We've got another 8 pieces of planking ready to nail up, but alongside that, we've got to cleave the next logs so that we can begin to make the next group of 10 planks to go into the ship. So the new year is going to be a very busy period. But we've started, and that makes a really good end to the year.
It's spring 2023, 4 years since the build began. The ship's company have been hard at work in the longshed. They've come a long way from the bleak days surrounding the cracked underlout, and planking is well underway.
You can begin to see here how the ship will look when she's fully planked. We've now got three strakes on the starboard side. We're ready to put the third strake on the port side. And then that's a third of the planking. So you can see how the nails are all beginning to line up. And it's that that really shows the artistry of the ship.
And as they progress, more details emerging in the wood.
The medullary rays, these lighter shaded patterns in the planking, they're indicative of the radially cleaved nature of the timber. So you will always see these in this type of construction. And it really is beautiful.
The Longshed's also got some fresh volunteers in the shape of the 23rd Parachute Engineer Regiment.
It's a real bonus to have them here, and hopefully we'll have more of the guys come down as they're available. We're getting ready now to start putting the framing in the ship. Won't be for another 3 or 4 months that we do that, but we need the space, and if we rough out the frames, we know at least that we've got them there, and it's beneficial to us to have some fit, strong, young men rather than all those pensioners.
After 3 months of waiting, the decision has come to start hollowing out the inside of the new stern underlout.
We put the moisture meter on this yesterday, and at the edges it's down to 18%, so it's dried considerably. If we don't hollow out the inside of the underlout now, we'll catch up to ourselves with the planking and get stuck, and the sequence won't work. So we need to get the planks on here on the garboards so that we can continue planking with the other strakes higher up the ship as we've done in the bow.
With work speeding up, project manager Jack has turned her focus to the fundraisers.
We're pretty close to Rivet 2000 going in.
Because people have sponsored these rivets, now they've gone in, we're in a position to email them and tell them where their rivet is. There's three more going on. The next one to go on will be this one, so that's strake two. Yeah. It's the port side. This is a unique identifier, so we'll know which tree this came from and which section of the tree, as it was cleaved, it came from. If there's any damage to this plank, if it rots or fractures, we can go back to our records. And we don't think that's really been done before in archaeological reconstructions.
3 months on, and there's been no time for haircuts. The trees felled in autumn are finally dried out enough to cleave, and everyone's come to help.
No, that's coming off there, look.
That's already gone then.
Watch your head then,
because I'm going in.
Well done, guys.
Yeah. It was like a mini earthquake there, wasn't it?
With wood for planking secure for the next few months, the team have been pondering what wood would best suit the oars.
The ash oars that we made, as they dried, they became very flexible, quite whippy, and that's not good for an oar. It needs to be stiff. So it probably means that the cross-section that we used, which is based on the new dam ship, was too slender. So what we're doing is experimenting by increasing the diameter of the oars and using a softwood, which should be a lot lighter than oak or ash, just to see what happens, really.
After many, many hours of work, the last plank of the garboard strake is finally going on.
This is one of the most difficult planking to fit, really, because you're not only fitting it into a rebate, but you're trying to fit it hard against the main backbone of the boat, and that'll just bridge that gap and hold everything nicely together.
Right,
This is our first visit of 2024. We thought we'd keep out of their hair for a while. Look at these. Don't you just love a nice tree trunk? I wonder how many planks they're going to be able to get out of that. Anyway, cool, I can still smell it from here. Let's see how they've been getting on. It's been a while since we were here. A few big changes.
Yeah, we've managed to get quite a bit of the planking on, particularly in the ends of the ship. So we've now got one, two, three, four. This is stroke five. So it's once we get to this stage, that's when we can start putting the frames in, the bottom part, the framing. The frames we've started to make, last time I think you saw some of the army engineers were here and we started cleaving those logs, and now we've made some of those frames that go in the bottom of the ship, and they are now ready to go when we've got the five strakes of planking on.
The rivets look beautiful, don't they?
They do. From the archaeological photographs and the plans, they're at very regular intervals, and it just so happens that they seem to be about a hand's breadth apart. So they put one in, move a hand, that sort of size.
Do you think that there was an aesthetic element in it as well as just being practical?
In all of these ships, throughout the 1,000-year period, they're all beautifully in line, but particularly it's noticeable in this ship that they all line up.
So what lies ahead in the next few months?
The next few months, the framing can begin to go in. It gives stiffness to the ship, and then we put the upper planking on, and then we finish the framing. That's what is believed to be the order that it went in.
And at least the troublesome piece of wood has its uses. What do we got here then?
Well, this is the offending item, the original underlout. It's now a display piece for the public so we can tell them the story.
How many hours do you reckon you lost?
Oh, we lost 6 months probably, total.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must have hurt.
Well, it's gone now. We've got other problems to solve.
And one of those problems is time. The 6 months delay and issues in obtaining more wood for the planking have now pushed the launch back much further to spring 2026. It does look impressive from down here, but are we allowed to go up those steps? Because I'd love to see the full majesty of it.
Yeah, come on, let's go.
But from the top of the ship, we can see that this project has clearly been worth its frustrations. Oh, that is so stunning, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes.
The ship's company have already started to breathe life into this magnificent treasure. And as work progresses over the next year, they'll attempt to build the internal sections of the ship, design its decorative carvings, and progress the water trials to find the right oars to row with the help of a bit more wood. How much does this log weigh?
About 7 tonnes.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, and the amazing thing is that the boat, when it's finished, is going to only weigh about 7 tonnes. It just goes to show how wet this log is, and also how little of the wood
you're actually going to use. Shut up!
Try that one, Tony. That one's 7 pounds.
Well, that's better. You was winding me up, weren't you? That's the way to do it. About every quarter of an hour or so, you suddenly hear click, 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 and everyone steps back. And then nothing more happens. Don't know how long it's going to take.
Step back, Tony, please.
Okay.
Can't have a national treasure under a log, can we?
Did you get that?
Wow, that is extraordinary. You weren't expecting that, were you?
No, that's not gone at all.
An incredible ship and an incredible legacy. And of course, we'll keep coming back here until its conclusion. But the really big question is going to be, will we be able to get it down this slipway? And if we do, and it gets out there, will it float? Join Time Team on Patreon to access exclusive 3D models, masterclasses, and behind-the-scenes insights.